Welcome to the Baked Potato Podcast. I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Rex.
Join us today as we discuss lesser-known serial killers, Kansas City Butcher, and Rodney Alcala.
Grab your green and let's get baked.
Today, I will be having apricot gelato, which is a cross between apricot jelly and gelato. And Leafly has to say about apricot jelly that it crosses Irene Apricot and Jelly Breath BX1. The sativa dominant hybrid has a citrus scent with a tropical taste resembling apricots. Gelato, also referred to as Larry Bird, is a tantalizing hybrid cannabis strain from Cookie Fam and Sherbinski, following in the footsteps of its parents Sunset Sherbert and Thin Mint GSC. This Bay Area California native gets its name from the fruity dessert-like aroma, a common genetic thread among the cookie family. Her buds tend to bloom in dark purple hues illuminated by fiery orange hairs and a shiny white coat of crystal resin. Novice consumers may want to approach this THC powerhouse with caution, but those armed with a high tolerance will delight in gelato's heavy-handed euphoria. Physical relaxation comes on strong, but many will find themselves still mentally agile enough to stay productive and creative when enjoying gelato during the day. And what are you having, Rex?
Well, Lindsay, I'm having Citradelic Sunset, crossing Ghost Train Haze and Mandarin Sunset. Ethos Genetics Citradelic Sunset has attractive lime green buds scattered with purple hues, ranging from sour orange and lime to a sweeter profile. This strain will make your mouth water. Back to you, Lindsay.
Well, that sounds delicious. And we will go to our respective bongs and consume these beautiful flowers and then come back and tell you some stories.
We're back and we're baked. Lindsay, today my story is about the Kansas City Butcher.
Ooh.
It was not an actual butcher, though. That was just his nickname because of his incredibly gruesome murders.
Because he liked to cut up people?
Because he liked to do more than that. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, though.
Okay.
The Kansas City Butcher was known as Robert Burdella Jr., who was born in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Like many serial killers, Robert had a real traumatic childhood.
Tell me about that.
I could tell you wanted to hear about that abuse.
No.
You just sounded so excited about the trauma.
Yeah, I didn't know what the trauma entailed, so...
It was not fun trauma, unfortunately.
What? The best kind of trauma is fun.
He didn't have any friends. He was ruthlessly bullied because he wore really thick glasses since he was 5.
Oh, like Coke bottle glasses.
Like Coke bottle glasses. And this was Coke bottles in the 1950s.
Yeah, so it really looked like you had the bottoms of two Coke bottles.
They're like 70% bigger than they are now. During puberty, he found out he was gay, which was really difficult in the 50s and 60s.
That was definitely a hard time to be gay.
He was terrible at sports, which was really hard for a guy. And it was especially tough because his father frequently reminded Bob that his brother was his favorite, and Bob was not.
Well, that's sweet.
Father of the year.
Yeah.
When Bob was only 16, his loving and supportive father suddenly died of a heart attack at the ripe age of 39.
That's super young.
Who would have thought that abusing your son like that would entail such a short life for you?
Yeah, so karma. There we go.
Obviously, you're a mentally and emotionally healthy person.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, after
obviously
his,
not.
after his dad died,
Bob decided that he was going to get a fresh start in life.
Okay.
He moved to Ding Ding Ding, Kansas City.
Where he became a butcher.
Hold on, we have a lot of story left. Bob went to the Kansas City Art Institute to become an artist.
Hmm.
Like many people with traumatic childhoods, they try to express themselves through art.
And been there.
What better place than Kansas City to start?
Yeah, it's not really the epicenter of art schools and art culture.
Despite these advantages, Bob became a drug dealer.
Mm. What kind of drugs was he dealing?
He was selling meth.
Oh, so like real drugs.
Like actual Kansas drugs.
Yeah.
Nah, it's the whole Midwest. And then a month later, he was arrested for the possession of weed and LSD. Which, I mean, like, come on, it's the 70s.
Yeah. Those are the flagship drugs of the 70s.
But unlike nowadays, it did not ruin his life.
Ah.
Bob's art career came to an unceremonious end when in 1969, the same year Abbey Road came out.
Oh, nice.
A great album. That was when he killed and cooked a duck in front of everyone for the sake of art.
Oh, yeah, that's not art. It's just sad.
Yeah, so unfortunately he was kind of kicked out of the Art Institute after that.
Understandable. Murdering a small animal and then cooking it in front of everyone is not very artistic.
Well, it's in the eye of the beholder, they say.
Art is subjective, but that is just cruel.
Bob worked, after college, Bob worked to friend male prostitutes, drug addicts, petty criminals, and runaways for the purpose of helping them out with their lives.
He did what with them?
He befriended them.
Oh, befriended. I didn't hear you. So out of the goodness of his heart, he's just helping people who are having a rough time.
That's right. The marginalized. He's just trying to make their lives a little better in any way he can.
Obikaby.
So his help was typically traded for sex.
Nice. That's usually what you do. You're like, hey, let me help you out. Then you can do me. And then we're cool. We're even Steven, man.
Since
airtight logic.
Since our relation has extreme power differential, would you like to come over?
Yeah.
Bob was described by his neighbors as, quote, a flamboyant yet helpful, civic-minded individual.
I didn't know his flamboyancy would get in the way of his helpfulness otherwise.
You'd be surprised.
Was he a pillar of the community?
Well, he tried to be, but he wore too many bright colored clothes or something. I don't know.
He was just too gay for that community.
That's right. Bob was part of neighborhood watch patrols.
Okay.
Which is kind of, pillar of the community-esque, I would say.
Yeah.
He also
keeping up appearances.
He also, in order to earn money, he was a cook.
Okay.
And then eventually settled on selling art and antiques in Kansas City. And by 1982, Bob established Bob's Bazaar. Bazaar. Yes.
Bob's Bazaar. Bazaar.
Bob's Bazaar, Bazaar.
Bazaar, Bazaar.
This is where he would entrench himself as the amoeba in the community, sharing relationships and meals with each other and the other merchants of the town.
Okay.
One of these amoeba-feeding bacteria was Jerry Howell, who was Bob's first victim. Jerry's dad owned an adjacent booth to Bob. Bob's Bazaar Bazaar.
Okay. So in the vicinity.
On July 5th, 1984, Bob tells 19-year-old Jerry that he'll drive him to a dancing contest. And to sweeten the pot, Bob offers Jerry alcohol, Valium, and an animal sedative.
That doesn't seem like a good offer.
But you get to go to a dancing contest. How could you turn any of those
while
free drugs down?
While you're tranquilized?
Maybe you could actually stand the dancing contest then.
I'd be turning down that offer, but that's just me.
Well, 19-year-old Jerry did not. And,
unfortunately.
Bob gave these things to Jerry. That's a weird way of phrasing it, but I don't really know how else to say.
He gifted these things to Jerry. Alcohol and Valium.
It was a scavenger hunt. In both Bob's car and house.
Okay.
After Jerry consumed those cocktail of drugs, Bob repeatedly drugged, tortured, penetrated, and raped Jerry for 28 hours.
Poor guy.
Jerry eventually died of asphyxiation, which was either by his own vomit, the gag, or the drug overdose.
That's sad.
So, in true butcher form, Bob drains Jerry's blood over a cooking pot.
Ooh.
He hacks up Jerry's body with a chainsaw and knife and puts Jerry's assorted parts into the trash.
All that effort just to put him in the trash?
Well, he did not want to get caught.
Well, the trash gets taken out.
Correct, so he would not get caught.
Well, the garbage man could see body parts in it, is what I was getting at there.
Yeah, well.
The trash isn't just a magical land.
The garbage guy was probably staying at Bob's house, let's be serious.
He's a pillar in the community.
That's right. According to Bob's journals, Jerry had repeatedly pled Bob to stop. April 10th, 1985. 23-year-old Robert Sheldon was a previous resident in Bob's house and asked Bob if he could come back to stay at his house. Bob considered him, quote, an inconvenience, and although he was not physically attracted to his victim, chose to drug and hold him captive on April 12th. Just so he could.
Because he's a fucking psychopath. And it sounded like a good idea to him.
Did we ever clarify which one it was?
No, we have not.
Okay, great.
We haven't even discussed it today.
We'll have to get 10 minutes of mumbo. Between psychopath and whatever the other one was.
Sociopath.
Sociopath. Yeah.
Well, we know he was either a sociopath or a psychopath. And I believe when you and I have discussed him in the past, I was on the side of psychopath.
Yeah, we'll let the listeners decide.
There's not a mental evaluation from the court records or anything that clarified.
We'll let the listeners decide. Sheldon was drugged, tortured by swabbing drain cleaner in his eye.
Oh. When I think of drain cleaner used in torture or murders, I immediately think of the club kids. Michael Alig, when he killed Angel, he poured Drano down his throat. That was one of the things he did to him. And that's always what I think of that murder when I think of Drano.
I'm going to pretend like I know about that and say that you're spot on and agree with you.
I should cover that murder then. if you don't know about it.
Teaser for the next episode.
Ooh, yes. At some point in the future, I'll cover Michael Alig's murder. Well, it's Angel's murder. Michael Alig did it.
Also subscribe to our Instagram.
At Baked Potato Podcast.
Other than doing the drink cleaner, Robert also inserted needles under Sheldon's fingertips.
Ew.
He bound his wrists with piano wire, and he filled his ears with caulk.
Ugh.
So that he could not hear.
Oh, poor guy.
And then 3 days later, Rob suffocated Sheldon with a sack over his head.
Oh.
And proceeded to dissect his body.
Ugh.
In true butcher form.
Hence the name, Kansas City Butcher.
June 1985. Rob Berdella found Mark Wallace inside his tool shed because it was storming outside. We've all been there.
So he just, like, took shelter from the storm in the random tool shed?
Inside Bob's tool shed.
Okay.
Bob noticed that Mark was not in a good mental state. So he offered Mark some sedatives.
Hmm. It's a trap.
That's right. After Bob injected Mark with chlorpromazine, Rob proceeded to torture Mark, including attaching alligator clips to his nipples until Mark was unconscious.
Poor guy.
1 hour after Rob inserted various hypodermic needles into Mark, he died from, quote, drugs and his gag on June 23rd.
God.
This is murder number 3 of the Kansas City Butcher, and this is where things start turning even more gruesome.
So we will go ahead and put in a super baked warning.
Today's episode of the podcast is rated SB for super baked. Make sure you load those bowls to the max. This shit is considerably depressing.
September 26th, 1985. Bob answers the phone from James Ferris, who wanted to stay at Bob's house. See, he was a real pillar.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why everyone wanted to stay with him. And that's why his trash guy didn't notice when the bloody body parts were inside the trash bag. He was like, this
that
dude,
stand-up guy Bob?
Yeah, he's probably, like, cooking meals for all these people in the house. Like, this is probably just the leftovers. It's probably not human remains.
Yeah. He's just a upright citizen.
He's a real pillar of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone locked their door.
Yeah.
Bob drugged James with tranquilizers after they had a nice dinner on the town. And proceeded to torture James for 27 hours. Bob applied 7,700 volts to James's shoulder and testicles for up to 5 minutes at a time.
Holy shit.
Yes.
That's a lot of electricity going to some very sensitive areas.
Wall outlets are 120 volts, so you do the math. Because we have it.
It's like 7 outlets.
With a factor of 10 in there. Oh, also during the electric torture, Bob was also applying hypodermic needles to the same areas.
Why?
I think Bob was a sexual sadist.
Okay.
According to doctors that put that on his Wikipedia page, probably.
Oh yeah, the doctors put it on the Wikipedia page. They're editing wiki articles in their free time.
How dare they misrepresent this man like this. I'm going to violate HIPAA and correct this once and for all.
Mm-hmm.
What did I say he was?
A sexual sadist?
Yes, he was a diagnosed sexual sadist.
Okay.
He also was depressed.
Oh, well. Welcome to the club, buddy. We have jackets, but we don't wear them because we're too depressed to get out.
Yeah,
mom jokes for the win.
On top of this torture, Bob repeatedly physically and sexually assaulted James until James finally died.
Mm-hmm.
Bob said this was the first murder that he intentionally inflicted torture.
Oh, yeah, because those other ones weren't torture enough.
Correct.
Like, every murder he committed was involved torture.
Not intentionally, Lindsay. Not just intentionally.
Accidentally torture people.
Yes. Who would have known that electricity goes through wires and alligator clips?
Mm-hmm.
It was the 80s. They didn't have
electricity?
Electricity. Yeah, they did.
I was not born in the Stone Ages.
When Nintendo 64 came out in 2007.
Like 1996, sir.
On June 17th, 1986, Todd Stoops had caught up with Bob. So Bob invited Todd over for lunch and sex.
Okay. It's a twofer.
A fun afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And proceeded to torture Todd at his house for 2 weeks.
At Todd's house or at Bob's house?
At Bob's house.
Oh, okay.
I did not mention Todd had previously lived with Bob as a drug addict and prostitute.
Okay.
And Bob offered to pay for the sex. It wasn't.
Okay.
It wasn't
like make it an official transaction.
Bob wasn't the romantic type. He was the practical type.
Okay.
So during these 2 weeks, he injected drain cleaner. I haven't used any today, have you?
No, I have not used any drain cleaner today. Nor have I tortured anyone today.
Maybe on the weekend.
Yeah.
He injected drain cleaner into Todd's throat to silence his screams.
Oh. No.
He used electric shocks to blind Todd.
How does that even work?
In my best guess, I'm not a physicist, but...
You're not?
Electric.
This whole time. This whole time I thought you were a physicist.
Shocking.
I feel betrayed.
This is my last show ever.
Yeah. Next thing you know, you're going to tell me your real name isn't Rex? What?
Electricity is a form of heat resistance, so I would assume that it was literally cooking Todd's eyeballs until he couldn't see anymore.
Oh.
And as you know, cooking damages the cells.
Yes.
That's just my guess.
That would make sense.
In week number 2, it just keeps getting more gruesome as the time goes on. Todd had asked Bob for a soft drink and a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
Bob said no. This was kind of the last straw for Todd.
Well, yeah, after you've been through all that.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
He got very angry at Bob, who in turn punched Todd's anal wall with his fist. Which ruptured it.
Did that make him bleed out?
Eventually resulting in sepsis and death.
Oh. Poor guy.
Near the end of his life, Bob noted that he couldn't keep anything down. There's one more murder.
Okay.
June 23rd, 1987. Bob bails Larry Pearson out of jail. Larry had previously lived with Bob and initially met when Larry was a child. And they had talked about witches and wizards and Bob's bizarre. Bob's bizarre. Bizarre. Bob injected Larry with chlorpromazine.
Do you know what kind of a drug that is? Like what it does?
Chlorpromazine is currently used. Actually, I don't know if it's current. Sorry. Because its use has changed. Because it was, let's see.
What kind of a drug is it?
It is a psychological drug. It is a type of sedative.
Okay, that's what I was wanting to know.
Okay, Bob injects Larry with a sedative, chlorpromazine. He injects Larry's throat with drain cleaner again to silence his screams.
Ugh.
He binds Larry up to a brick column. That is his torture place.
Mm.
Larry was, quote, by far the most cooperative victim.
That's even more sad.
On day number 5, after shocking Larry with an electric transformer and breaking his hands with an iron bar, Bob really felt like he had earned Larry's trust in Bob's physical and sexual assault.
Ugh.
Bob told Larry that if he kept it up, he would no longer torture Larry.
Mm.
That was not true.
Mm.
After 6 weeks of torture.
6 weeks? That's so long.
6 weeks.
Oh, that poor guy.
Larry.
I know I've said that a lot, but I mean it.
This other poor guy, yes.
Yeah.
After 6 weeks, Larry bit Bob's penis.
Mm.
After
he got a little bit of revenge on him.
After which Bob immediately suffocated Larry.
Mm.
So yeah, he did go out with some revenge.
Yeah, he went out with a bang. Went out with a bite.
Genius.
Oh, yes. Ba-dunch.
Bob went to go get treatment at a local hospital after he killed Larry.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
And the story's over? That's into the hospital?
His murder story, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just saying he went to go get his dick repaired.
Did they question him at the hospital about that injury?
Yes. In another age when sexual assault was not rampant.
Yeah.
Probably just gave him more sedatives, honestly.
Yeah.
March 29th.
We'll cut the dick commentary out. It doesn't really add anything to the story.
Well, I don't know. Our listeners may want to know if he walked around with a bloody dick for the rest of his life.
Gross. If it was bloody the rest of his life, then there's something else going on besides just a bite. It shouldn't continuously bleed.
If he never got treatment for it, could have gotten infected.
Ugh. Then he would have died of sepsis. But he didn't. So what happened after he went to the hospital?
Well, you'll know the end of the story. May 29th, 1988. Bob abducts a 22-year-old prostitute named Chris Bryson, who he lured to his house for sex. Kind of a theme here.
Yeah. Being a sexual sadist and all.
Bob knocks Chris out with an iron bar and proceeds to torture Chris using one of his most tried and true methods of swabbing his eyes with ammonia.
Ugh. Why?
Sadist.
Yeah.
Because he was the Kansas City butcher.
Mm.
He was also a sexual sadist.
Yes. We've established this.
After day number 3, Chris had, quote, earned Rob's trust and persuaded Bob to tie his hands in the front rather than above his head because of poor circulation, which is where Rob had tied them off for the torture.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, Bob inadvertently leaves a book of matches in Chris's room. which he had used to burn his hand bindings, and jumped out of a window from the second floor.
Oh, wow.
He subsequently broke his foot, but he was able to get to a meter reader and told them to call the police.
Oh, good. So Chris survived.
Chris survived and the police made it.
Yay.
Happy story.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Or was it?
Better ending than everyone else is what he got.
Chris told officers he was repeatedly sodomized, drugged, had his throat injected with drain cleaner for 4 days.
Ugh.
In addition to his broken foot that he got from the window, which is what I just said. And he was also wearing a dog collar.
Oh, poor guy.
Chris was also able to give police the key evidence of Robert's address. And he also provided implicating evidence, telling police that he was shown Polaroids of Bob's previous victims.
Oh.
Rob had called them his, quote, unsuccessful sex slave collection.
Gross.
Police immediately go arrest Bob because now they have all this evidence of these horrible crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And at his house, they found the following. Burnt ropes that Chris had gotten free from.
Mm-hmm.
An electric transformer tied to wires.
Ugh.
A metal tray with syringes.
Ugh.
Drugs. A human skull inside the second floor closet.
Ugh.
This was later found out to be Robert Sheldon's.
Okay.
A partially decomposed human head in the backyard.
Gross.
This was found to be Larry Pearson's.
Hmm.
They also found several human vertebrae. They found teeth in an envelope. These were also Robert Sheldon's. And those were the two murders which Robert was charged first-degree murders for. And convicted on.
Okay. Did they not have enough evidence for first degree in the other ones?
I believe they just didn't have any physical evidence. Like, they found the remains of those two guys, but not of anyone else.
Okay.
Because he had cut them up and put them in the trash.
Yeah.
They were never recovered. Yeah. Just threw them away. They also found 334 Polaroid pictures.
Ugh.
And 34 additional prints of various males, many of which were taken during torture, and many of which we can include in our Keefe notes this week.
No, we will not.
Not all of them are depicting torture.
Just so you guys know, the Keefe notes are like our footnotes for the episode. It's where we list our sources for our research and usually include a couple pictures of either the victims or the person that we're talking about on that episode. And there's always a link in the podcast description to bring up that PDF.
We have some non-traumatizing photos.
We'll see.
We'll peer review and get right back.
Yeah. I don't usually put crime scene photos in the Keefe notes.
They also found a book on narcotics, which undoubtedly influenced Robert's cocktails that he gave his victims.
Okay. His kind of source book for the drugs.
They found a notepad with detailed torture logs.
Aww.
And he had actually told police that he stopped detailing these tortures for his last three victims because he didn't think they were going to make it.
Ugh.
They found several news clippings of Jerry Howell, of Jerry Howell's death, And they also found James Ferris's driver license. So they had a pretty good amount of circumstantial evidence for the other victims, which is why they were able to get second-degree murder charges to stick.
Okay, good.
So he was tried and convicted of 2 first-degree murders and 4 second-degree murders.
What was his sentence?
It didn't really matter because he died on October 8th, 1992 because of a heart attack.
Just like his daddy.
Just like his dad. His trial judge, Alvin Randall, noted that, quote, "It couldn't have happened to a nicer guy."
Well, fuck you. He's not a nice guy. He's a piece of shit who tortured and killed 6 people.
Yes, that was a very sarcastic comment.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also had to take Polaroids of Bob's nude body in order to rule him out of all the photographs they found.
Gross.
So that was just great.
Some poor intern having to take those pictures.
And then he also...
Do police stations do interns?
Sure.
I probably don't. Sorry, come on. Rookie cop, get in. Yeah. That's more like it.
Drop his drawers. Mm-hmm. While he was in prison, the local news media interviewed him. He stated that he was just trying to restore his image as a sensitive citizen who had simply just made mistakes.
Nope, that's not what happened.
And that he had also been demonized unfairly by the media.
I think it's pretty fair.
And, yeah, that's about it. Well, we can link his prison interview in the Keefe notes. There's no gruesome stuff there.
Okay, yeah, we can do that. Well, thank you. That was a brutal yet good story. And we can smoke a bowl and then recollect so I can tell you about Rodney Alcala, the dating game killer. We're back and we're baked, and I'm going to tell you the story of the dating game killer, who was Rodney Alcala.
This is what people did before Tinder. They would go on nationally televised game shows.
The dating shows.
For a chance at a date.
Yeah, for a chance to be picked to go on a date.
When airplane tickets were at their highest.
Yeah. So, a little bit before that, born in 1943 as Rodrigo Jacques Alcala Bucor, Rodney had a pretty normal upbringing compared to most serial killers. He was born in San Antonio, Texas, to Raul Alcala Bucar and Ana Marie Gutierrez. When he was 8 years old, his father moved the family to Mexico just to abandon them there 3 years later.
That's pretty not normal.
This caused his... Yeah, that was the thing. Like, that's the biggest event in his upbringing. This caused his mother to move the family, which was Alcala, his 2 sisters, and a brother, to a suburb in Los Angeles by the time he was 11 in 1954. So, but other than that, normal.
Other than a few traumatic events, it was pretty normal.
Yeah. Mental illness didn't start to show, at least not that we know of, until 1964, when he had what was described as a nervous breakdown. Mm-hmm. Having joined the United States Army in 1960, he served as a clerk until said breakdown. And military psychiatrists diagnosed him with antisocial personality disorder and gave him a medical discharge.
So they just set him free.
Yeah. Antisocial personality disorder is normally characterized by long-term patterns of manipulation, lying or deceit to exploit others, arrogance, disregard for right and wrong, hostility, and lack of empathy. Most people with APD use charm or wit to manipulate others, which allows them to continue their deceitful behavior for long periods of time. another name for this personality disorder is sociopathy. So he is a sociopath, a diagnosed sociopath.
And emotional abuser.
Yes. He also does a lot worse things. Alcala claims to have a genius-level IQ, but that hasn't been proven, and a lot of sociopaths believe they're smarter than everyone else. He did graduate from UCLA School of Fine Arts and later attended NYU using the alias John Berger. Under this alias, he was successful in studying film under Roman Polanski.
What is it, spelled like Berger?
No, but the alias he moves to next is John Berger.
Yeah.
Genius level IQ here, Rex.
John Pizza.
Yeah.
John Taco.
So, during his time as John Berger, he committed his first known crime. On the way to school on the morning of September 25th, 1969, 8-year-old Tally Shapiro was stopped by Rodney on Sunset Boulevard. He asked her if she wanted a ride, and she replied, "I can't talk to strangers." Rodney responded, "I know your family," and eventually convinced her to get in his car by telling her he had a beautiful picture to show her.
Uh-oh.
A man noticed this taking place, and after the little girl got into the car, he followed them to an apartment complex and called the police. By the time officers arrived, Tally was lying in a pool of blood on the floor with a steel bar across her neck. She had been raped and beaten. Then he tried to strangle her with the bar. And Alcala was nowhere to be found as he had escaped out the side window.
Okay, that was my question, was he still there?
No. Okay. So he escaped, and amazingly, Tally survived her injuries, and police were now after Rodney Alcala for the attack.
Right.
But the little girl survived.
That's really great.
Rodney had fled to the East Coast, where he attended NYU. By summer 1971, he had changed his alias to John Berger.
Yeah.
And started a counseling job at a New Hampshire arts camp for kids. He also liked posing as a photographer. Just before joining the camp in June 1971, 23-year-old flight attendant Cornelia Michael Crilly was found raped and strangled in her Manhattan apartment. At the time, the police had no strong leads. And the case went unsolved for 40 years until 2011, when it was linked to Alcala by his dental impressions.
Mm-hmm.
He had bit the victim and left his teeth marks on her.
That's awful.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in early 71, the FBI added Alcala to their 10 most wanted fugitives list and featured his picture on posters for the attack on Tally Shapiro, the little girl. Two children from the arts camp recognized him from a poster at the post office. He was then extradited to California to face charges. By this time, Tally Shapiro's parents had moved her family to Mexico and therefore would not come back to testify. This prevented prosecutors from convicting him of rape and attempted murder, so he agreed to a plea deal for the lesser charge of assault.
Oh no! He got off on a technicality!
Yes.
Ah, shit.
So, it gets a little bit worse, too. He ended up only serving 17 months of his sentence, being paroled under the indeterminate sentencing program that was popular at the time. This program allowed parole boards to release offenders as soon as they showed signs of rehabilitation. It took a whole 2 months for him to get sent back to prison for assaulting a 13-year-old girl after offering her a ride to school. Court records only identify her as Julie J., so we don't have a lot of information on this attack. By 1977, he was back out on parole under the same indeterminate sentencing program.
Oh, he got it twice?
Mm-hmm. Continuing his undeserved lucky streak, his parole officer took the unusual step of allowing a repeat offender and known flight risk to relocate to New York City. It's now believed, like, that was a whoopsie on his part.
Well, he said he would come back.
Yeah. It's now believed by New York cold case detectives that Alcala murdered 23-year-old Ellen Jane Hover of the week he arrived in New York. Ellen was the daughter of the owner of the popular Hollywood nightclub Ciro's and goddaughter of Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr.
So got publicity.
Her remains were later found buried on the Rockefeller Estate in Westchester County, New York.
Jeez. Yeah. He had a problem with celebrities.
That was the most, I guess, celebrity-esque of his victims.
But it seems like very targeted towards famous New York celebrities. Not really at all.
While he was in New York.
Sure.
So, during the late 70s, Alcala was back and forth between New York and L.A. In 1978, he worked briefly for the Los Angeles Times as a typesetter. He was interviewed by the Hillside Stranglers Task Force as part of their investigation of known sex offenders. They ruled him out for being one of the Hillside Stranglers. We now know that Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Buono Jr. did... Wait. We now know that was Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Buono Jr.
They were the Hillside Stranglers.
Sorry, I can't read today. Yes. But they did manage to arrest him for marijuana possession, and he served another brief sentence. His favorite thing to do in his spare time was pose as a photographer. Alcala convinced hundreds of women and children to pose as models in his photographs. So this brings us to 1978, the year Alcala appeared on the popular show The Dating Game. It is from this appearance that he got the nickname The Dating Game Killer.
It's related to that.
At the beginning of the episode. Yeah. Was that redundant?
He got his name, The Dating Game,
at the beginning
killer,
of the-
because he was on the hit show, The Dating Game.
The Dating Game. And he was a killer.
Spoiler alert. He's only, like, raped several people now.
Yeah. At the beginning of the episode, host Jim Lang introduced him as a successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the darkroom at the age of 13, fully developed. Between takes, you might find him skydiving or motorcycling.
I mean, skydiving's pretty cool.
Yeah, he was trying to be
cool. The whole dad story about the photographing was pretty lame.
Rodney was chosen by The Bachelorette and won the game.
He was just that charming.
However, well, after meeting him backstage, Cheryl Bradshaw refused to go out on a date with him because he was, quote, too creepy.
He was giving off serial killer vibes.
Yeah. June 20th, 1979, a 12-year-old girl from Huntington Beach, Robin Samso, disappeared between beach and ballet class. Prior to her disappearance, witnesses describe a man with long curly hair on the beach that approached her and her friends to take pictures. 12 days later, on July 2nd, her decomposing body was found in the Los Angeles.
That sounds like something a photographer would do. Take pictures.
Mm-hmm. Police circulated a sketch of Alcala and his parole officer.
Uh-oh. Man, how could you rap me out like this? I thought we were cool.
Right? He lived with his mom at the time, and during a search of her residence, police found a receipt for a storage locker. Inside this locker, they found the victim's earrings. He was arrested and held without bail. In 1980, he was convicted and sentenced to death for the murder of Robin Samso. This conviction was overturned by the California Supreme Court since jurors were improperly informed of his prior criminal history.
Did this guy ever play the lottery?
It gets worse.
He keeps winning the legal system.
He received a second trial in 1986, basically identical to the first trial minus the prior sex crimes, and was again convicted and sentenced to death. Rodney took this all the way to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, whose panel nullified the second condition. This time, it was in part because a witness was not allowed to support his contention that the park ranger who discovered the body was, quote, hypnotized by the police.
What?
Yeah. He was finding any asinine reason he can to get out of that conviction.
The park ranger was hypnotized.
Yes, hypnotized by the police. So, while awaiting the third trial in prison, Rodney wrote and self-published a book proclaiming his innocence titled You, the Jury. He even went so far as to suggest a different suspect. He also kept himself busy with lawsuits against the California penal system. One was for a slip and fall, the other for failing to provide him with a low-fat diet.
Aww. He got fat in prison.
Because when you're in prison for raping and killing children...
You gotta look good.
You should have better preference in your diet.
Yeah. I mean, you still deserve to get cut in prison.
Cut?
Swole. Muscly.
Oh. I gotcha. Shanked. By 2003, Rodney... By 2003, Rodney had to give a DNA sample under a new state law. Orange County investigators linked him to the semen left at two rape murder cases. By 2004, they had linked him to four cold cases by DNA. He was indicted for the murders of Jill Barcombe, an 18-year-old runaway from New York, found in a Los Angeles ravine in 1977. And she was originally thought to be a victim of the Hillside Stranglers.
Mm-hmm.
Until, obviously, they linked Rodney to it. Right. Charlotte Lamb, a 31-year-old woman who was raped, strangled, and left in the El Segundo apartment complex's laundry room in 1978. Earrings containing her DNA were also found in another storage locker of Alcala's.
I bet those were his tokens. Georgia...
Yeah, because he kept them from
his the water. His trophies. The earrings.
Yep. Georgia Wixt, a 27-year-old, found bludgeoned to death in her Malibu apartment in 1977, and Jill Parento, a 21-year-old, killed in her Burbank apartment in 1979. The case finally went to trial a third time in 2010, where Alcala was charged with five murders. Like so many sane men before him, he chose to represent himself this time.
Let me guess, he got off immediately. He was that brilliant of a lawyer.
Ah, not quite, but close. Not only did he act as his own lawyer, but he questioned himself as a witness.
Ooh, that's genius. You can't legally lie to yourself in court.
The jury literally had to watch this man address himself as Mr. Alcala in a voice slightly deeper than his natural tone.
Mr. Alcala, don't.
And you can look up the trial on YouTube and watch him talk.
Don't raise your voice to me.
At the trial, he kept stating that he was at Knott's Berry Farm the day Robin Samso was killed, although he offered no alibi for any of the other four murders. He tried to attack the victim's mother on the stand to question her character, stating she brought a gun to his first trial.
And that's not a good look, Rodney.
She admitted that, yes, she did in fact bring a gun with her to the past trial. She planned to shoot him between the eyes in court. When she went to grab the gun from her purse, she smelled her daughter's shampoo and said she felt her presence, so she stopped. So, one person Rodney didn't expect to see at the trial was his first victim, Tally Shapiro.
Ooh.
So, the little 8-year-old girl who had moved to Mexico and couldn't be at the first trial.
Did she testify against him this time? Yes!
Now an adult, she came back to testify about his attack on her 41 years earlier in 1969.
Ugh.
In his closing arguments, he played a song by Arlo Guthrie titled Alice's Restaurant, in which the protagonist tells a psychiatrist that he wants to kill. Great way to prove your innocence.
Isn't that the song that's like 30 minutes long?
It was like pretty
long, yes.
And he played it in court. Finally, in March 2010, he was sentenced to death for a third time. Despite three convictions for the same murder, four new convictions for first-degree murder, and DNA evidence, he continues to maintain his innocence on death row at San Quentin. But that's not where our story ends.
I mean,
In April 2010, the Huntington Beach and New York City Police Departments released 120 photographs of women and children taken by Rodney Alcala from the late 60s until his arrest in 1979. An additional 900 could not be released since they are too sexually explicit.
Oh, shit.
The police wanted help. Yeah. The police wanted help identifying people in the photos and making sure they didn't become victims of his. At least 21 women came forward to identify themselves in the photos, and in 2013, one cold case murder was officially linked to some of the photos. Christine Thornton was 28 when she went missing, and her body was found in Wyoming in 1982. There are still 109 photos on the police website unidentified to this day, and I need to find a link for it to put in the Keefe notes, but if you Google Huntington Police or Huntington Beach Police Department Rodney Alcala photos, their website comes up to where you can see the photos. So if you were in California in the 70s and you might know someone from the photos, you can help solve some crimes.
You're going to put up your dead body website on the Keefe notes, but I can't put my dead body stuff on there.
Well, we don't know if all of them are dead, because we don't know if they became victims of his or not. They haven't been identified. They might still be alive.
But his nickname's the dating show killer.
No, it's the dating game.
Dating game killer. Fuck. His nickname is the dating game killer.
Yeah.
Well.
Because he went on the
date. Who would have thought representing yourself in court would go bad?
Yeah. It worked out so well for everyone else.
And when you play the lyrics of a song as your closing argument.
Yeah, because that's not weird at all.
He was the artistic type of lawyer.
Yes. So that is my story.
He's currently still on death row.
Yup. And he'll probably just die there eventually of old age.
Do you think he'll...
California hasn't done executions since like 2005, I think.
Oh, so being on death row doesn't really mean anything right now.
Right.
So I'll probably just die in prison. Okay.
Most likely.
Well, thank you, Lindsay. That was a very interesting story.
You're welcome. Always good to have a creepy photographer story.
I mean, who doesn't like following people and just taking unconsented photos of them?
Oh, yes. His were mostly consented, like, because he would convince them to model for him. But hundreds of photos. Well, thank you for listening. And if we got anything wrong or you want to let us know something, you can email us at bigpotatopodcast@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Instagram at Big Potato Podcast. Subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. It helps us out.
Please subscribe to us.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we will see you next time when we get baked and we try to podcast.